Ronaldo's got that twist now and pivot in the air.
Yeah.
I look at him doing that and I'm thinking, ooh, be careful. Yeah. That's like cruciate. That's potential cruciate in the making.
Subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast stream wherever you get your podcasts and download the OTB Sports app.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
And you'll be welcome along, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. We are ready for you. Whatever you want this morning, you can get in touch, 0879 180 180. That's the WhatsApp number. Or, of course, you can leave a comment on the YouTube stream. Plenty for us to talk about. The return of the Champions League. The battle for the salt of Gaelic football. Is it fair to fair to phrase it that way?
Yeah, it is.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like that's what's happening here. And I know everybody's like, they roll their eyes at us when we talk about fixtures and fixture form. But this is it. We've been talking about this, I'd say, for 40 years. And this month it's going to be decided. And so this month is the chance for something remarkable to happen. Or this month is the chance for everybody to go, I don't really want something remarkable. I'm kind of happy with a wishy-washy in between. A little bit of this, a mix 'em, gather 'em. A not very interesting new version of the old version of what we have, which is clearly broken.
Mm. A very compelling case to try and push change through is made by Kieran Shannon in the Irish Examiner this morning, which is that hurling will be in the shop window for May and June next year. So football people, gather your tools and ensure that that does not happen, because he's right. We will go back to a state of play where we won't really want to watch any football in the early summer months. We will want to watch the incredible new hurling championship, which will be back with a bang, no doubt, next year.
I think that was a dangerous thing to point out. I think that as soon as everybody in the hurling community realises what might be on the table here for football, they'd be like, ha, 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 ha. How do I somehow manage to sabotage this? That's like, because that's what they'll do.
Well, it's true. They also have a vote in all of this.
Yeah.
Like, and the thing is, the hurling community could come together and they could single-handedly bring this thing down, because do hurling counties make up 40% of the voting Congress? I mean, if you include John McDonough teams, they probably do. So that's a powerful vote.
You've got to get them on side. And really, are they going to vote for a world where football becomes one of the best and most interesting and entertaining and brilliant things in world sport? I think that Gaelic football is on the verge of a massive breakout. There's a great line where he's talking about Clare and Galway potentially both being Division 2 teams this year and having a rivalry, considering they have a border, they share a border, and they should be rivals. They've literally never played each other in a championship. But there's a new system that we have where they could play each other essentially every year, and that rivalry would explode, as opposed to Clare in the championship playing Kerry every year when they're not quite ready for them just yet. They might be if they were to get out of Division 2 and get into Division 1, because they'd have put together a brilliant campaign, and maybe they might be able to play them in a league scenario, which was obviously propelling them forward to a championship. But just why does this matter, Owen?
Well, because of the reasons that you outlined, that football is on the edge of something special right now. And even kind of if you ignore that a little bit, football, if you go back a couple of years, felt like it was in a state of needing to be saved, and the championship structure was letting it down so badly. To be honest with you, the way the football championship went this year, I thought it was relatively good and relatively exciting, and we didn't really know the outcome. And that might actually hold this thing back, because people might get notions that, you know what, it's okay, let's keep it how it is. But just because something is okay doesn't mean you can't make something even better. But why this is important and why this conversation is important is that everything that gets passed at GAA Congress needs a 60% support. You've got a Proposal A, you've got a Proposal B, who are going to go toe-to-toe in Special Congress, and they are probably going to split the vote unless there is some sort of consensus in the public conversation, because let's not forget that option C is to keep things as they are. When it came to the Super 8s and when it came to getting that in, Shannon refers to Pádraig Duffy as the daddy of the Super 8s, and one of these proposals potentially needs a daddy in this situation, and needs somebody high profile or a collection of high profile people to lend their voices to this and actually say, this is what we want. Because if Congress is tomorrow, we are going back to the GAA Championship, the football championship that we had from 2017 at the very best. That is what we are going to get. So it is up to GAA people who want change to make their voices known. It is up to people in this fixtures task review force to actually make their voices known. If they are the ones who have instigated these motions, then it's up to them to actually come to the fore and put their head above the parapet and actually say, this is what we want, because you do need this sort of momentum publicly, and you do need to persuade a hell of a lot of people who are on the fence to vote for what you want. It's how politics works, and it is how GAA politics works, and unfortunately that is the reality of how good things tend to happen in Gaelic games.
Yeah, and this, like, the prize on offer is all the best teams playing each other. You talked about Conor Callaghan being down in Killarney next May for a match, and then there being loads of other matches like that. If you can just catapult yourself forward. Imagine being from a county where your best players have something to play for in the best weather, and it's a fixed programme of games, and at the end of that there's an opportunity for them to play in an All-Ireland quarter-final, semi-final, final. So whatever county you're in, you can actually start the campaign dreaming of that. If you go on a run, you're going to get something big happen, and there'll be all-stars for your division, which will be obviously highlighted and spoken about, and then all of a sudden you can start thinking about, like, well, let's have fantasy, and let's have highlights programs and highlights reels for every individual county, and all of a sudden it's a much stickier sport. People want to stick around and play it. They're not going off to America for the summer because actually there's 7 games for them of inter-county football. Is that not a better world to live in?
Well, like, it absolutely is, and the random nature of the GAA calendar would sort of go out the window a little bit more. We would have something far more regular, something that is on a far more fixed schedule, and everybody would benefit. This is something that would fit in beautifully with the big change last year, which was seeing a split season come in. Now, there is some talk that if, as a result of the split season, that if these changes are rejected, maybe even the football championship will have to go back to the pre-Super 8s era. And I know this is a little bit of an aside, but in the likely scenario, I think that neither of these two proposals go through, what do we want? Do we want a situation where it's just a regular knockout qualifiers, or do we want the Super 8s? And to be honest with you, I'd actually go for the Super 8s. I just think that the more football we get between high-quality teams, the better. I know there are dead rubbers in both years that they operate, but we have to remember that the best team of all time was playing in one of those groups.
And got 2 home games as opposed to, oh, it's neutral because they don't really play in Croke Park. I mean, come on. We lived in a fantasy world where everything was fine. And we could choose not to live in a fantasy world. We could choose to live in reality and make a brilliant dreamscape. That's what I think is on offer at the moment. And that's why I'd be really hopeful that things will work out.
We probably also need to realise that everybody benefits. And I know I said that just a moment ago, but everybody would benefit from this. Like, if you're involved in the provincial council, chances are you will benefit from this. You will have your provincial grounds being used for bigger games, for a much better competition, for the counties within that province to be in the shop window for a longer period of time, playing against similar opposition. The sport benefits, and as a result of that, everybody involved in the sport will benefit. And this idea that there are vested interests in the archaic mechanisms of provincial championships just doesn't make any sense. It's not like if you're involved in the Connacht Council or the Ulster Council or whatever like that, that you're going to lose your job or something like that. Those bodies will still exist. In fact, I think that those bodies will be enhanced as a result of a better football championship, and your role may actually be important. So I think it's even in the self-interest for everybody involved in this to vote for this. This is not turkeys voting for Christmas, as far as I'm concerned. Yes, the Ulster Championship is fantastic, and yes, we would like to preserve those rivalries. But the thing is, we will preserve those rivalries because all the good teams in the Ulster Championship are going to be in Division 1 anyway. They're going to be playing each other anyway, except for the fact that they also get to play Dublin and Kerry and Mayo on top of playing Tyrone, Donegal and Monaghan.
The one point about the Ulster Championship that I think seems to be missed in all this is that, like, you weaken each other by... So Tyrone managed to come through this year and win All-Ireland, but when was the last time that somebody actually managed to come through all the way back to Donegal, right? Like, what has happened in the meantime is that the bite taken out of the Ulster champions on the way to provincial glory has resulted in them being weakened. What you're now doing is saying, we're going to weaken the Dubs, we're going to weaken Kerry. If Galway come back or if Mayo are there, we're going to weaken them along the way, the same way we're weakened. We're going to get video on them. We're going to get evidence to see where their best players are. We're going to find out the backdoor cuts before they pull it off against us in the All-Ireland final. It's like, it makes far more sense for me to engage the Dubs in tribal warfare earlier in the summer and then get another crack at them later on. No?
Yeah. Like that would certainly be the tone from someone like Sean Kavanagh, I suspect, when he was on before the Kerry game saying that nobody would lay a hand on Kerry before getting to the All-Ireland. I think he would share that view. I do think that there is a legitimate view, though, that to counter that, which is that it does battle harden you. But, I mean, is that really...
How often has that worked for them, though?
Yeah, or like, it's true. Like,
in history, how long has it worked? Kerry with their handy All-Irelands, 30 of them in the bag. The Dubs with their handy All-Irelands, 5 in a row, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could also make a case that they're actually just the best teams in the country around this time. But anyway, that's maybe a conversation for another day. Like, I think that there is a view in Ulster that actually they have something unique, which is they have a very competitive
Their house is in order. That is unique, in fairness.
Yeah, and they have something that is genuinely
special. This isn't punishing
them
for that. This is rewarding them for that.
No, and you're still going to have your provincial championship at the start if you go with this new format. And obviously, both of the proposals have changes that keep the provincial championships. I don't know. I think everybody benefits from this. I think everybody just gets a little bit of a kick in terms of football. So yeah, it just comes back to the thing we first said: hurling could destroy this house of cards.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could get something we deserved once, just in our lives, once? At the end of the pandemic, if what came out of it was, you know, a lot of pain and heartbreak for people and time missed, and then at the end of it, we've got this amazing football championship, you'd be like, is it worth it?
Listen, I mean, we will. I'm going to. If this championship proposal doesn't go through, I'm going to emigrate immediately. You said the players are going to emigrate. I'm going to emigrate because, like, why not? Why is life worth living anymore if you don't have a new championship proposal?
It's 7:42 this morning here on OTBAM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock this morning. Talking GAA reform with former Clare Hurler and footballer, or Clare Hurler and footballer, Pod Collins, rather. Sports pages at 8:15. Sports news coming your way at 8:35. We'll obviously be talking about the Champions League a good bit this morning. Philippe Auclair is going to join us at 8:40 to talk to us about the incredible adventures of Paris Saint-Germain. Ronan Mullen is going to join us at 9:10 to talk to us about the fallout from the heavyweight division at the weekend. We now have a new belt holder of three of the belts, and we've got Fury Wilder coming down the tracks in a couple of weeks' time. What does that mean for us? And then we play out with Kenny Egan this morning at 9:30. Now, if you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. And I'm delighted to say Podge Collins is with us. Podge, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, Ger. How are you keeping?
We're good. We're a bit exercised about what's happening at the moment because it feels like one of the biggest and most important months in the history of Gaelic football is ahead of us. And we kind of feel a little bit like we're sleepwalking into what's going to happen at Congress. Can I ask you, as a footballer from Clare, what's the best thing that could happen at Congress? What would the best outcome be for your colleagues and for the people who are coming after you and the generations to come for Clare football?
I suppose just from the proposals that have come out, I think proposal 2 is probably the best option. It's definitely not perfect. It's far from perfect. But it kind of, I suppose, leads the way for what could potentially be, let's say, a championship in the future that you would kind of be happy to play in. I suppose from my point of view, like, you look at the LGFA, I feel like they've really got that football championship right. When you see, let's say, junior champions and intermediate champions like celebrating on the field the way they do every year, regardless of what championship's called, you're nearly envious because there's a cohort of teams that basically at the start of every year, once the league is over, their year is over, because there's essentially like 4 or 5 teams that are competing for Sam Maguire, and it's a system that's broken, and this is kind of a way of changing it. And unfortunately, when it goes to special Congress and it has to get 2/3 majority, it's not always easy. But I suppose it's just about getting people to understand what these two proposals, I suppose, outline, and I suppose why, in my opinion, a proposal 2 is kind of the remedy for it at the moment.
So just to be clear for anybody who's unfamiliar, and people are definitely only waking up to this at the moment, Proposal 2 is essentially where there would be 4 divisions and everybody would play in a league format, and the that would decide who ends up playing for the Sam Maguire. So the league gets played in summertime, and the winners of the league are the winners of the Sam Maguire.
No, well, essentially, the top five teams in Division 1, the top two teams in Division 2, Division 3 and Division 4 champions would play off to decide your quarterfinalists at the end of the year. So if you can just picture, like, it's like a flip format. So the way the league is at the moment, you've got your four groups of eight. The top five from Division 1 go through to the quarterfinals. The top two from Division 2 go through to the quarterfinals. And then the winners of Division 3 and Division 4 play off. Now, the reason I think that it's proposed like that is that everyone has a chance. Everyone's in Sam Maguire, essentially. And some counties, that seems to be some sort of an obsession with people. In my opinion, I don't think that a lot of teams can win Sam Maguire. So I don't see why the obsession is there to be in it. It's like, I know, let's say, for example, Leicester, I suppose, true underdog story in the not-so-distant past, were 5,000-1 to win the Premiership, but they were still in the Premiership. They weren't in the Coca-Cola Cup, or it wasn't, they weren't in Division 2 football to win the Premiership. I just think that it's unrealistic to think that teams that are further down will win Sam Maguire, so I don't see why the obsession is there that everyone is in Sam Maguire, but this is the way it's set up. And I suppose the main argument then, Ger, for the teams... Let's say in Division 1 could argue that, oh, if I finish 6th in Division 1, I'm at a disadvantage to, let's say, the winners of Division 3. But I suppose my argument to that is, if you're not good enough to be in the top 5 after 7 games, you probably don't deserve to win Sam Maguire anyway.
Yeah, so you've had your chance at that stage. It's like you've obviously had a pretty bad season to finish 5th in the, or 6th rather, 6th. Like, when you think about it, you're the 6th best team here and your form is terrible and you're going out and you need to get your house in order and you're lucky not to be getting relegated.
Yeah, and like that's it. Like, end of story. You've had like 7 chances to kind of to be in the, now, like, I know that teams from the stronger counties will say, like, league form mightn't have been great some years and they would have finished 6th and then had a great championship, but this is the championship. So you'll have your, let's say, provisional league at the start of the year between February and March. So this will be your championship. So it'll be kind of, you'll be giving it everything. You'll be peaking at this time. It's not a case of like, it's just the league and you might finish 6th and then you'll be very disappointed. But that's like, listen, I think that same in Division 2, if you're in the top 2, you have a chance to qualify. And if you come 3rd, and regardless if you're like, let's say the winners of Division 4, like a better chance of, let's say, reaching a quarterfinal, they still have to beat the winners of Division 3 to get a quarterfinal spot. And like, if I suppose the way it's set up is that everyone kind of has an opportunity to play in Sam Maguire, so that's the way it is.
It's also, Podge, when people talk about moving the league to the summer, which proposal B is, the drawback, say, from the perspective of some people maybe in Ulster, is that you're moving the championship to the spring and therefore your kind of blue ribbon Ulster championship games are moving down the pecking order. But actually, those top quality Ulster games, for example, are going to be present in this format because all those top teams tend to be in Division 1 anyway, or in the upper echelons of Division 2. So you will have these Ulster derbies in just a higher stakes scenario in the middle of the summer. So I think that people are missing a point here that there's actually a huge boon for some of the provincial councils here for these local derbies that might actually happen in the league anyway.
Absolutely. You're going to have the best games being played in like peak conditions, and like, you're going to avoid, I suppose, what you're trying to get rid of. You want it to be competitive. There's a number of things going at play, like you're avoiding hammerings, which are happening every year, like, and especially for the northern counties, who would probably be the only ones that could argue that their, let's say, provincial championship has been a success. Like, every year you hear the narrative coming out that Dublin have an easy way to an All-Ireland semi-final, Kerry have an easy way to an All-Ireland semi-final. And this alleviates that. Like, it makes it a fairer competition, in my opinion. And then, like, I think to what you're getting at, Owen, is that these, let's say, provincial councils that might feel like that revenues will be down, it's quite the opposite. From my point of view in Clare, I know that people in Clare are crying out to support, let's say, the Clare teams, given the opportunity. And if you have 4 home games in Cusack Park and 3 away games, championship every year, like, you're going to get, like, fans are going to start coming to games. I think you're going to end up with more revenue. It's going to be more gates for GA. I think it'll be a better competition. You'd almost have that kind of, like, a soccer kind of fan base where you've got like home and away games and people like they'll be week in, week out looking forward to it. I think it is, it's a really, it is an improvement on the model. It's not perfect, but improvement.
And then just to add to your point as well, Podge, when you look at, I know this is not the headline part of it, but these provincial championships that are going to be moved to the spring, these are not the provincial championships that we know. Currently, the provincial championships are knockout. These provincial championships are going to be round robin. So Leinster and Ulster are going to be split into two groups. Munster and Connacht will stay as they are. So if they are round robin, there will be more games in the province than we are used to currently in the summertime. More games equals more people into the stands equals more revenue for the provincial council. So you're bang on. This idea that the provincial councils is like turkeys voting for Christmas just does not wash with this proposal B.
No, absolutely not. So, and like it is a case of that when it goes to special Congress, you're kind of, you're nearly at the, you're at the mercy of probably the, I suppose, the people in GA, let's say, would have a say, that have a vote, these delegates that have votes. I'm not actually not 100% sure who's actually voting it. Is it just going to be county chairmen and a county secretary? Is it just two people from each county in this special Congress? But I suppose it's just important that to put on the table, like I know myself that I've met, bumped into a few people just over the last few months in different scenarios and talking about this, there seems to be like, oh, they won't go for it. They won't go for it. It's like it's a bit too radical or whatever. I just don't think it's radical at all. I think that it just makes sense. And from everyone I've talked to involved in GA, it's definitely not perfect, but it's definitely the best proposal of, let's say, the three. Like proposal one, like I think, as apart from being very confusing, I don't think it'll work. And then going back to the original proposal, like I really don't think that the championship at the moment is fit for purpose. I think there's too many teams that when the league is over, their year is over, and the enjoyment from a spectator is kind of gone out of it until you get to All-Ireland semi-final stage. When it really heats up, you can nearly pick the four semi-finalists for the start of the year most years.
Yeah, so yeah. Let's not do that again. And then there's this third proposal, which, as you say, is not perfect, but which represents an opportunity for almost everybody to have meaningful games. It literally represents an opportunity for everybody to have meaningful games. So you get your house in order in Division 4, you can get promoted to Division 3, you can get promoted to Division 2, and all of a sudden you're playing seven games in summertime with all your best players keen to play because there's something meaningful to play for and there's progress. Like, it's very interesting to watch how Clare football has progressed over the last decade or so, and the difference between your league form and your championship form is quite marked, but that's because you end up playing one of the superpowers of the game almost every year.
Yeah, I suppose you come up against Kerry every year, and we've been very unfortunate probably with the draw that we've kind of had them. We've got them so much, and like they're a powerhouse, like in Munster, and like nearly, it's one I think about a lot, because like winning a provincial, let's say, for to someone like me and Clare, winning a, like hurling or football, but winning a football in particularly, like in 92, like it would be massive for someone in Clare, but for someone in Kerry, having a Munster medal means very little. Like some of the players, let's say from Paul Galvin, Gucci's era, like they were quoted as saying like that, like, listen, I think they had 12 or 13 of them. And it loses all kind of value to them. Obviously, when Tipperary won it last year, it's something unbelievably special for that group of players. But yeah, like it does kind of take away from it nearly the fact that, like, I suppose Kerry would have very little mass in a Munster medal. They'd have much more mass in like a National League medal. I suppose the one thing that maybe this format proposal 2 is kind of losing out on is the league finals is one thing that, from my point of view, has been a massive success, bringing them to Croke Park. Division like 1, 2, 3, and 4, and just from, like, one of my best days in with Clare football was like playing Kildare in the league final, Division 3 league final, and like I know like the Derry and Offaly game was watched like by a lot of people, and like I think those league finals they're probably the best part of let's say the current format.
Well, you could keep those. I mean, here's the thing. If there are little tweaks that you need to make along the way when you've got everything going, if that is like an end of Division 4 and the winners of that are going through to the playoff, play that game in Croke Park. Like, if there's two teams, whatever way you need to do it to extend, if there's one extra week where you need to give those teams an extra game and play for a cup, and the winners are guaranteed extra money for their holiday fund or something, like, there should definitely be ways to fix those issues, because they're small enough, right? That's like not a massive thing that you're asking for. It's recognition that the champions of Division 4 are better than all the other teams, and they should be treated slightly differently. That's fair enough. Likewise, Division 3 and Division 2 to some extent. Or maybe Division 2 is less important because it's all about qualifying and getting promoted. But Divisions 3 and 4, you know, if that's the equivalent of the Talton Cup, then go for it.
Yeah, and like it's just, I suppose there's obviously going to be good things from the current structure, and probably the Ulster Championship and that those league finals are probably the two things that are good, but the whole system's just completely flawed, so that's why it needs to be changed. So regardless of what they like, the fact that they are good things, there needs to be change, and I suppose the sooner it happens, the better for GA, for football. I think like playing 7 competitive games against teams at your standard will only like bring on, let's say, the fan base. It becomes a much more marketable product to Gaelic football. It's the most played probably sport in Ireland, because you've like 32 counties all play it, and it is it needs to be revamped. And the championship is like it's dying for most teams, like, and you're going to have players just dropping off, and you see some coaches already like walking away from it, and
I was going to ask that about from the Clare perspective. So you've clearly invested loads of time and effort in getting promotion to make the group more competitive and keep the group together, and you know, it's a very tangible progress that you've made, and yet then the draw gets made and it's Kerry in the championship. There must be players who are thinking, what's the point? Like, the league progress is great, but ultimately it's very difficult for us to compete in that championship.
Yeah, I'd always be of the opinion like we've a chance, like even though any time we go down to Kerry, they've ran up serious score on us. Like we've had some very competitive games with them in Cusick Park. We had 2 very competitive games. I was involved in one of them in 14 and in 16. Like, I suppose we missed a few goal chances after half time. Donal Kowalt was sent off, and we were kind of a point up, I think, and with a win. But James O'Donoghue came on and kind of went to town on us that day. And like in 14, it was 114 to 13 points, and it was a very competitive game. When they come up to Ennis, it's kind of, I suppose, it's more competitive, but we still haven't like turned them over. Which was like what Cork did down in Páirc Uí Chaoimh was quite special for them. But yeah, listen, I personally, Ger, like I don't think like that. Probably maybe some people might think that's a bit naive or whatever you want to call it. Anytime like you kind of getting ready for championship, you're just training as hard as you can, let's say, and trying to kind of give it your everything. But yeah, going down to Kerry, I suppose getting hammered is definitely not enjoyable, and it's a pretty sombre way to end the year.
It's not great for Clare football. There is another scenario where the new format comes in. Clare win Division 2 off the back of 7 very competitive games, and as champions of Division 2 get a home draw, and out of the hat comes the 5th place team or the 4th place team, who happened to be Kerry, and you guys have them in Ennis, and now all of a sudden you've got massive confidence, you've got strength and depth from having been able to try players out in the heat of championship. It's going to be a closer game, you would expect.
Yeah, and like I think even from, let's say, the teams that win Division 3 and Division 4, like they will have huge momentum after 7 competitive games. They'll have got a game plan that they'll be happy to play towards. Like I do, there is an awful feeling at the moment of like the league ends, you're kind of, let's say, you've got a week off or whatever, and then the championship happens, and you literally kind of, maybe you don't have a lot of time to prepare, you don't kind of feel prepared. It's the league is just like feels so much more important to, let's say, I think teams from the end of Division 2 down to the bottom of Division 4. So it's yeah, like this flip model just makes perfect sense. I think it's going to be, you're going to have more competitive games. You're going to have more people interested from around the counties. You're going to, like, I think you'll have more people going to the games. I think it'll improve, revamp football. I think it's just something that needs to happen. And I listen, it's great that, I suppose, you're so interested in talking about it. And the more it's probably out there in the media, I suppose, the more kind of pressure that will come on from the people that, let's say, have the power to vote. And unfortunately, they're the people that will decide the fate of Gaelic football in the coming weeks.
And what do you want them, what do you want to say to them this morning? Because we're going to clip this and we're going to put it out. What do you want them to hear when they're looking at their social media and when their kids are showing them on social media? Here, you've got to vote on this, don't you, Dad? How are you going to vote, Dad? What do you want them to say?
Well, like, I suppose, like, I'm of the opinion that Proposal 2 is the best option for Gaelic football. There's no selfish reasons here. It's from let's say, County Dublin to any other county in Ireland, it just makes sense. The best proposal. Everyone knows that the league format has been working the best. we want that as championship, because championship is championship at the end of the day. And like in every county across Ireland, when you go into your, let's say when you transition from league to championship with your club, like it's just a different level of, like it's a different intensity, it's a different pressure. So that's like those games when they're transformed to championship, they just add, it's an added value. So like there's obviously a few different things at play that need to come into it, but they, like that's like end of story. I just think that proposal two, like I've gone through it in detail, is the best proposal for the GA. And I just don't see why anyone wouldn't, let's say, go for it, or why it would be like, why anyone would knock it on the head. I'd love to have a debate with anyone on it as to what is better than it at the moment. Obviously there's improvements to be made in it, and I'd probably, like, that's not the debate I'm talking about, but compared to proposal one or compared to what's there at the moment, proposal two just is by far the best.
Yeah, it seems to make endless sense to get it up and running, and then when it's live, whatever the kinks are, we can work those out. Just, you're obviously from a family steeped in GAA. When you're talking to people around the country, and I know you're involved with the players' organisation as well, like, are you sensing that this is actually what everybody else wants? Because we had Tony McEntee on last week, and he was as bald as you, saying this has to happen. Like, and so he obviously is from an Ulster county and understands exactly the importance of the Ulster Championship. Is one of those players who has more Ulster medals, I'd say, than almost anybody else alive at the moment. And he's saying, no, actually, it's time for us to go. And that's not just the short-termism that he has as Sligo boss, but it's somebody who fully understands it. Here's you, who's played inter-county hurling and understands what the top tier of hurling looks like, and playing in football, saying this is what we need. So are you seeing it? Are you coming across anybody who says, I don't really think it's a good idea, or what's your sense of how successful this might be?
Yeah, well, like, just from my own point of view, like being on, let's say I'm in a kind of a fixture task force with the GPA, and like having players, let's say, like Niall Morgan involved in that, and talking to like Tom Parson, and talking to these regularly, and just people from different counties, it just gives you such assurance that this is the right thing. It's not like this is better for Clare GAA or Clare football. It's better for Ireland and football as a whole. And that's the important thing here. Like the GPA canvas, like, or not canvas, but they got all the players to vote on the proposals, let's say. And proposal two came at like 78% of players voted for proposal two. I feel like that if you got in front, I suppose if the whole picture was painted of each of the proposals, that number would increase. But when you're obviously sending out an email or sending out a text message, to get 78% back, I think, is just massive. It just shows the appetite that's there from every county. This isn't like just a few counties kind of going on a solo run. This should be like 32 counties wanting this. And it's for Gaelic football to become a better sport. And like even like you, I see, like I'm nearly envious of soccer in Ireland sometimes, like when you see like the way they've such a good fan base, because like they've so many games throughout the year, home and away, and they're so passionate about it. And I feel like that this is kind of something that will come through this kind of structure. You'll have a much better fan base, home and away.
Sorry, Pat. And also it's like worth pointing out that while on a national level, if we're taking this, like what you said, 78% of players, on a national level, that may not seem like something that can influence Congress. On an individual level, that absolutely is something that can influence Congress. All these people hold such high respect in the minds of these county men and women that are going to be going to Croke Park, or if it's on Zoom, I don't know what the situation is, for that special Congress, that individually you speaking to your representative within your county who is going to appear in Congress will have a huge impact. Maybe this national conversation might not have the desired impact, but certainly if all of those 78% of people who voted in that survey are making direct representation to their representative at Congress, that will make a significant difference towards getting to the 60%.
Yeah, absolutely. And trying to find out in your county who those people are, and just having a word and why you think, like talking facts about the situation, like just putting the three proposals down in black and white, and being like, okay, if you don't want to, let's say, vote proposal two here, why would you not? Because I don't think that there is an argument to not vote for proposal two. So I think that it is something like going, like you're saying, that like would be great if people could do, and people in each county to contact the delegates that have a vote. So like I'll be trying to do in my own county in Clare anyway, when I find out who has the vote.
When you hear that the players are overwhelmingly in favour of it, do you hope that this is a time where the players' voices are actually centred, that it is an opportunity for us because the relationship, it seems like, bizarrely, the relationship with the players as a group seems to have been kind of fractious over the years, as opposed to like, oh, what do you guys think about this? Well, that's very interesting. Maybe, have you thought about this? It's been like, wow, let's all have fights. You know, it's really weird that we, as an organisation, it's kind of, there's constant tension there, as opposed to, well, what is actually the best for the supporters? What's the best for the administrators? What's the best for the players? And then what's the best for the casual sports fan, who we are actually very interested in because that brings in a lot of money too.
Yeah, and like I think that they're, like you said, that there's a lot of people invested in it. And I don't see a financial benefit of keeping the current structure over, let's say, the change. I don't see the advantage from a spectator's point of view over the current structure over a change. Like, I just don't see where the advantage is not to move proposal to. And like, even like the Talton Cup, I'm not even convinced about that, just the way it's set up. I think that there has to be a big marketing job done around that, nearly, around how they'll structure it, in that proposal. I think that has to be looked at, and I think that it will. This has to happen. And it will develop over the years to much better structure. And the way it's done, I think, will eventually, it will get better. But, maybe a situation down the line where you will have a situation where, let's say, 5 teams in Division 1, 3 teams in Division 2 go through, and then, Division 3 and Division 4 is a separate competition to, let's say, Sam Maguire. But obviously, if you get promoted from Division 3, you're in Sam Maguire. So that's kind of something that could be looked down the line. There's, loads of different tweaks that could be made eventually to, let's say, improve the setup and make it better for, let's say, everyone. But at the moment, this is definitely our best option.
From speaking to fellow players, and not necessarily just about your own situation, but is this literally the sort of thing that is the difference between you staying and leaving the game, whether it's the country, whether it's emigrating, whatever it is? But is the championship structure the thing that can keep more players playing Gaelic football?
I think absolutely. I think players would be very excited to play in this format. I think playing 4 championship games or 4 championship games at home and away, or whichever way it works, 3 away, 4 at home, I think it's a very attractive prospect for any GAA player to be playing those games in the height of summer in front of probably a bigger fan base. So I do think it'll get more people involved, it'll keep people playing the games longer. I think you'll just have a better product, GA point of view as a whole. So I really do think it's a no-brainer here.
Yeah, look, I totally agree with you, and so we obviously are sitting here talking about this every day, but it's great to hear somebody who's actually at the coalface going, no, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. It feels like it's the opportunity of a lifetime. You get this right, Gaelic football could be ready to explode, because it'll actually, deep into summertime, the best players in that county will be available for everybody to go and see in their local ground, playing a match against a rival of similar standard, where you don't know whether or not they're going to win or lose. It's exactly what every sports fan wants.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a kind of, nearly every other sport in the world has kind of gone down that route. The hurling's gone down that route a good few years ago. The LGFA have gone down that route. It just seems to make sense. Playing competitive games as your championship is what everyone should want. So if you find someone that's against it, is arguing against it or debating against it, I wouldn't mind having a debate with them.
Well, look, if we can find somebody, that's the thing. We don't know who's going to be ending up making these decisions, but we're definitely having trouble finding people coming forward saying, no, this is no good. Here's why, apart from Jim McGuinness. But apart from that, we haven't found anybody yet. So we'll keep looking. Pod, great to have you with us. Thanks a million for sharing all that with us. Cheers.
Thanks, Ger. And Owen, good to see you at home.
We were all a little bit worried there for a while.
It was good quality. Fair play.
You're famous now, Owen. Good man, Pod. Thanks for that. It's 8 minutes past 8 this morning. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. What do you think?
Really interesting stuff. Because when we have these conversations, you're never quite sure if the people that matter actually agree with what we're saying. Because we're just fans. We just want really good quality action, maybe for our counties, maybe from a neutral perspective. We just want good fair, and we want good stuff to talk about. We'll put our cards on the table. That is a huge part of what we're saying here. But when you actually hear this volume of people actually on side with what we're thinking as well, you just start to think that really all the stakeholders involved would benefit from this. And the more I think about it, the more I'm actually changing my view that the one area of concern, which is the provincial councils and those people who are really attached to the provincial championships, Ali Jim McGuinness, I'm starting to think that they would actually benefit from this as well. I'm thinking that there is a there's an opportunity here for more games in Ulster, for bigger games of a local rivalry, if they're of the same quality. And I'm just struggling to find the reasons not to go with this. Now, I think it came up in this conversation quite a bit. There are kinks in this. There are definitely things to be ironed out. But the way GAA administration works, this is not the time to be trying to iron things out before the thing gets through. The way to do it is to put the cart before the horse, almost, and get the thing through, and then iron things out, because it is a much easier process then. You've got to accept the imperfections, because this is as close to perfect as you're going to get. It's not all the way there, for sure, but it's as close to perfect as you're going to get for now. And
yeah. Eat the horse one bite at a time, or the elephant, whatever the crappy business speak analogy is. And like, here's the opportunity. The one thing I'd say about the pre-season competitions, like, I distinctly remember Kildare winning an O'Byrne Cup in Newbridge and a speech being given and crowds around and the lifting of the trophy being a thing, because they were so starved of success that it meant something. And there was a core of that team who were really good and who did go on to lead the team to an All-Ireland semi-final. And you were like, "This, there's something building here." So if Kildare were to win a Leinster in March, it would be absolutely massive. It would be a proper thing. The other thing is that those games are going to be coming around at the start of the year, when it's been 6 months since we've seen inter-county action. We'll have seen the club action on TV, fair enough, but it'll be an injection of inter-county jerseys and the opportunity to go to your local ground again and see the best players on the best teams playing with each other who you've been watching playing for their counties for the last couple of months. So if they're marketed properly, I've no doubt they'll be marketed properly. I've no doubt that there will be interest from the TV companies in showing those fixtures, because we all want to see how those players who came through over the club championship are being bedded into the team. And that's your local rivalry right there. And the fact that at the end of it there's a trophy and it lives in and of itself, that's not a negative.
No.
That catapults you forward into all of a sudden, that first league game, when that ball gets thrown in and the crowd is full in a local stadium, it will be full, at least for the first three matches. While you're still alive, it's going to be absolutely feverish in summertime. What's not to like about this?
Yeah.
It's transformative.
And like you talk about the marketing of something, the easiest marketing tool is an outstanding product. And this is a product that will be so easy to market. It will be an absolute cinch for whoever the marketing manager at the GAA is, because there will be good fixtures all the time. And your pre-season point is
endless highlights on social. Endless.
Yeah. The pre-season point is spot on. Like, and you throw into the mix there the fact that the All-Ireland champions will go into those provincial championships probably a month behind everybody else in terms of their preparation, because they've gone out on a team holiday. They will be vulnerable, and there will be an opportunity for them to get dethroned were they to be the previous year's provincial championship. So the situation is ripe for those provincial championships to throw up what we had 2 years ago in the middle of the pandemic with Cavan and Tipperary. Like, Cavan and Tipperary are more likely to win their provincial championships in the future were the championship to be changed than the championships that they actually won, I think.
Yeah.
So
they were fluky COVID years.
They were to a certain
winter
degree.
Time.
To a certain degree, and I think that actually there's a greater opportunity for them to target that. And I mean, Kieran Shannon makes the point that maybe there should be a greater reward for the provincial championship. But again, that's just a little crease that needs to be ironed out over a period of time. Maybe
more money for your holiday,
or home advantage all the way, or a higher seeding, or whatever it may be. But like, there could be something in there. Right now, you're not going to be able to make changes to this proposal unless something extraordinary happens between now and then. But certainly you see it 1 year, and then you can be even more confident that the crease exists and at the following year's Congress.
Give us your view. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. Leave a comment in the YouTube stream or tweet us at OffTheBallAM. Are you in favour of this proposal to go forward or not? And do you know any of the county board delegates? Because if you do, send them the clip of Podge Collins this morning saying, please, come on, come on. You've got it right in your hands right now. You can fix it. Let's just see. Give it a 3-year term. If you want to do that, I don't think you should, by the way. I think it should be like all duck or no dinner. But if you want to like give yourself a little bit of wiggle room, no, this is terrible. Too many people are going to our games and they're seeing it in high summer and look at the fielding. Stop it. Stop the good quality. Gaelic football is terrible. Maybe we could experiment at least, you know. Are you experienced? 14 minutes past 8 this morning here on OTBAM. Thanks to Gillette, we're celebrating the return to normality with a special prize of UEFA Champions League tickets to watch Chelsea against Malmo on the 20th of October with flights and accommodation included. You can enter the competition via the Off The Ball Twitter page. You'll see the competition post pinned to our profile. We need you to respond to the post and tell us who the person is for your chance to win this amazing prize. The hashtag is best face forward. Put your best face forward with Gillette. Who is that? Ooh, salt and pepper. Nothing wrong with a bit of salt and pepper beard, is there?
It's in, I think, isn't it?
It's 15 minutes past 8. A very busy show still to come here on OTBM. We're going to talk about the rugby situation with the women's team. We're going to talk a little more about the GAA situation too with Will. Would adding semi-final for the winners of provincial championships add some gravitas to that competition? Otherwise, it's just dressed up a Burn Cup, FBD League, etc. Is it a bad thing that the GPA has endorsed option B? I don't know, Peter asks. That's a question. The fact that the players are in favour of this, does that mean the county board delegates are like, nope. No. That's kind of what I was getting at. It was like, we've got this weird fractious relationship with our players who are the ones that we, you know, all want to go and see play, who are the local role models.
That should not be the case whatsoever. Like, I mean, someone like Niall Morgan should be a hero to the Tyrone delegate. Niall Morgan has provided the happiest moment of that Tyrone delegate's year, I suspect. Unless, I mean, that Tyrone delegate got married or had a child. But maybe even not. Maybe Tyrone went into All-Ireland.
I mean, Shane Lowry was saying he was crying after that and he didn't even cry after his like baby or the Open.
There you go. Like, I mean, these people provide the lifeblood of your happiness throughout a year. Surely they have the utmost respect for these people and will listen to these people who are the members of the GPA. Maybe they need to make direct representation and just make it abundantly clear. Like, don't assume that these delegates know what you're thinking. Actually writing to them, picking up the phone to them, talking to them, saying this is what we want. I think that is the way you can ensure this thing happens. And I still have a concern though that there is another proposal here, proposal A. This is not a black and white thing, that this whole vote getting split could be a danger here. But proposal B is markedly better than proposal A. And
they need sexier names.
Yeah,
Prop 2 needs a sexier name. It's all about the marketing here.
It could be like fastest finger first and who wants to be a millionaire, and you could get people just accidentally pressing the wrong button.
That has happened. That has happened before. Well, with the testing of the votes.
Yeah.
They want everybody to press the yes button, and apparently a proportion of no's still got. I mean, that's true. I can dig that up in the ad break. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back after these. OTB AM. 18 minutes past 8 this morning here. We're going to talk about the Champions League with Philippe Auclair in just a few moments. Time first, going to run you through the sports pages. We can start with otbsports.com. Alex Ferguson and me, 20 years as Manchester United's kit man. It's the latest in our Carries FC road shows. Joshua is very insecure about his chin, says Kenneth Egan. We'll bring you that a little bit later on in the show as well. You have to feel for Park Harrington, says Dermot Gleeson, talking about Europe struggles. And Roy McIlroy needs to go back to his natural playing style. The best horse we've ever had, said Mark Basilica, retires unbeaten as a 3-year-old this year. So I'll run you through the sports pages. Start with the Irish Times. It's how you handle the pain. Pep prepares City for Paris Saint-Germain test, and it's a picture of Pep Guardiola against Mauricio Pochettino, which will be rivalry renewed on the sidelines tonight. Klopp warns Liverpool to forget the past. I didn't realise the last two times that they've played at Porto, 5-0 and 4-1 wins. So anything less than thumping victory for Liverpool tonight is essentially failure. And then Philip Lam in a piece from The Guardian, Paris Saint-Germain, the French capital's latest luxury brand, hunt European glory. Philip Lam's a very smart person. If he wrote this piece himself, he's a genius, and I've no reason to doubt it. And did he write the piece in English? Is it possible that he's like so bilingual, he's writing with this amazing I don't know if you read this yet this morning, but it's excellent, and it's carried, obviously, as I said, in The Guardian, it's in The Times and The Examiner as well. On the banks of the Seine in Paris, 5 minutes from the Louvre, stands the Saint-Martin department store. The building was last renovated at a cost of $750 million. The interior is wood panelled. There's a VIP area. No doubt Philippe Lam has been in it. The product selection consists of Dior, Gucci, Prada and Louis Vuitton. Shoes cost €1,000. Champagne bottles can be personalised. Perfume bottles can be bought for six figures. Even in the pandemic, the luxury goods business continues to grow. Do you see what he's doing?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what he's drawing
sounds
parallel.
Like a metaphor, to be honest.
It's an excellent one. People want to see it like the Eiffel Tower in Notre Dame. One marvels the owner, Bernard Arnault, the richest European, has gathered all the noble brands in his fairy tale castle. And then he goes on to talk about, for 10 years, PSG have belonged to the ruling family from Qatar, who are doing exactly the same thing, except instead of bottles of champagne and 1,000 euro shoes, it's human beings, flesh and blood. And, you know, he talks about how the players are popular with rappers. The club has even become a part of pop culture. Their videos reach 9-digit viewing figures. Paris Saint-Germain are integrating into the fashion industry. Christelle Cocker, kosher? Blank stares from you.
Yep.
Created a PSG shirt that retailed for $3,000. Beyonce, Leonardo DiCaprio, Mick Jagger have been seen in her collection. It's fitting for Paris, the metropolis of fashion and extravagance. And how did you feel being a willing participant in this human flesh pot?
Wearing my 1,000 euro shoes.
Did you buy a Paris Saint-Germain shirt?
No, I did not.
Not even a knockoff outside for a tenner?
There was no knockoffs outside for a tenner. If there was, I'd have bought a few. You know, sold them at an uptick on the price back home. But no, I didn't particularly engage in that. Of course, those 1,000 euro shoes did the same price as a Ryder Cup jacket, as Nathan Murphy pointed out yesterday. But it's a really interesting piece. And if you're talking about using a football team as a vehicle for sports washing, it is the perfect institution, or close to the perfect institution. They're doing an even better job than Manchester City on that front, I would say. And they talk about the way they've managed to just instill themselves into the pop culture. Like, I'm not entirely up on what rappers he's referring to there. Obviously, we would have had Dave with his song Thiago Silva a couple of years ago. Like, I'm not sure is that necessarily in reference to his Paris Saint-Germain club at that time. And I remember MIA was in a row with Paris Saint-Germain over a modified club shirt back in the day as well. So that they've had a checkered relationship with artists in the last couple of years. But what they have is an unbelievable fan base, a fan base that have obviously had massive controversy themselves down through the years, but it's not like this is a totally plastic club. They have...
No, they were real.
Absolutely authentic. Absolutely authentic.
Not very good.
No, but they have a very authentic setup. This is not Red Bull. This is not the sort of creation of something that feels like a simulation. This is very authentic, and it's a very, very effective form of sports washing, I would say.
Yeah. All right. The back page of the Herald is Pep, I've no idea how to stop Paris Saint-Germain. He lied. Klopp, I'm not worried, but defence needs to be better. This is after the 3-3 draw at the weekend. Solskjaer will never be good enough. There's just that is like, it's very difficult for Solskjaer to get rid of the stink, isn't it? Every single game is a referendum on him. And it's just very difficult for that never to be the case until he wins something big. The Irish Examiner this morning, c'est formidable. Guardiola fears deadly PSG trio are unstoppable, except they're not, because obviously Club Brugge managed to draw 1-1 with them, a point Philipp Lahm made. Lahm's talking about Club Brugge had an IPO that failed. I did not know that either. So it's like the ultimate two different, one form of capitalism and another form of capitalism going up against each other. Maybe that's not that ironic at all. It's kind of exactly what happens. And Kieran Shannon, Gaelic football needs to hear voices for change. So he's talking about several managers have already piped up, most namely Tony McEntee and Colm Collins. While they're understandably underwhelmed about the proposal calling for 4 18 provincial conferences, they're strongly in favour of the alternative. You were talking about that piece a little bit earlier on. It's an excellent piece. We recommend everybody read it. You can get it for free on the Examiner website. And we need it, right? This is our time. Mm. Tonight's our night. The Indo back page, Ireland need new coach for rebuild, insists Doyle. This is very interesting. Rory O'Connor, Claire Molloy has obviously announced her retirement from the international rugby team. Philip Doyle, who was the head coach when the team was really successful, has called for successor Adam Griggs to be replaced. A major reform after the national team hit rock bottom. A completely new coaching staff is needed, a fresh start. A lot of players will be gone. Those sevens players will be gone. They won't be seen in the 15s jersey for quite a while. That means we now have to build a whole new backline. When the seven starts kicking off properly, it clashes with the Six Nations. It's almost like you could have predicted that there would be an issue with putting all your eggs in the sevens basket and taking them out of the 15s and then not getting to the World Cup because you wanted to go for the gaudy thing of the Olympics, which, does anybody really care about rugby in the Olympics?
We do for 2 days.
Yeah, but whereas actually the team qualifying for a World Cup is the type of thing that you build on over an 18-month period.
It's a sustainable thing. It's something that you become familiar with over a period of time. You watch the World Cup and you're like, oh, there's a Six Nations next year. You become familiar with the players, the management, and it becomes a far more effective brand as opposed to the 1 week every 4 years where people watch the sevens. I mean, in an ideal world, you could possibly have both, but in this situation, it's pretty clear that the 15s was totally neglected.
I mean, people were saying it at the time as well, so this isn't completely after timing. The Daily Mirror back page: Citizen Payne.
There we go. Top of the morning to you, I think. Well, I mean, congratulations to
the Mirror.
The Mirror this morning.
Pep warns his side to expect night of suffering thanks to Neymar, Mbappe, and Messi. Citizen Payne. What's the Zen? Citizen
just
Payne.
Like Citizen, like that's City's nickname.
What?
Aren't City the Citizens? That's their nickname, so I mean they're oh, okay, sorry, I just didn't why are you looking at me like that? What have I done wrong here? So
what's the pun?
Well, I know it's Citizen Kane.
Okay,
I know that.
Okay, grand.
But I think it's a double pun
because it's there's the citizens.
The citizens as well.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But then just City is in blue. How do you spell Citizen again? It is Z-E-N, is the last three letters of Citizen.
Yes, on. did they suck an important part of your brain out in that Ryanair flight too?
Yeah, they did.
Hero Mope makes him pay late on. We didn't even talk about that. Poor Brighton missed the opportunity to go top of the table, and maybe that's what's. Maybe that's kind of where they are. How do we stop him? I don't know. It's funny how that one press conference is really. But there's news in the back of the Star. Booty Cal. Manchester United want to sign Calvin Phillips from bitter rivals Leeds. Apparently they've gone cold on Declan Rice, or are they just trying to provoke Declan Rice into asking for a move a little bit earlier? Would Calvin Phillips be better than Declan Rice for Man United?
I'm not sure he will be.
I'd like to see the stats.
Yeah, like obviously Declan Rice is somebody of a far greater profile, has been spoken about in connection with the bigger clubs for far longer. Maybe there's like a prejudice there a little bit in how he view them, but maybe even with England at the Euros during the summer, Southgate would use Phillips in a more advanced role than Rice. He would be the one bombing forward a little bit more. Manchester United don't exactly need that. They need somebody who plays a little bit deeper. So if Southgate was signing one of the two, it suggests to me that he would go for Declan Rice. Not that Gareth Southgate is the deciding factor in all of this, but no, I think Rice possibly over Phillips.
The Irish Daily Mail: we will suffer, says Pep. Very self-flagellation, kind of monastic, religious overtones about what's going to happen here, isn't it? Yeah. Or else it's like kinky sex clubs in Paris. I don't know.
Yeah, probably that. Is it just downplaying his chances? Is it
come for the championship restructure talk and get kinky sex club in Paris as well? Where else would you get it?
Well, we could just flip the table, come for the kinky sex club talk and stay for the championship structure.
It's more likely, isn't it?
It's how you get them in. Welcome along to our club. Now, proposal A or proposal B. Why is everybody here dressed in leather, Ger?
Larry vows to get Ryder Cup revenge in Rome. He's got to be part of the team. Things took a turn quickly. The front page of the Telegraph. So how long will it take the Telegraph to start blaming poor Carrington? Let me see. Is this the appropriate amount of time? Is that gone? Woods plea to step on their necks inspired record US win. A graphic message from Tiger Woods to the United States team inspired their record-breaking Ryder Cup win. The 15-time major winner reportedly sent a text prior to the final day urging the team to step on their necks. It's ironic, obviously, because Tiger got a bit of a bad neck. Haven't had the spinal fusion surgery. He texted the US team literally telling them to step on the next. When was this though? On Saturday night. So it was before the singles. And they did, apparently. The record was 19 points. We should go out and try and get the 19 points. That's what we did, says Jordan Spieth. So there you go. They knew what the record was. They went and they got it. And they are the dominant force in world sport. There is nothing as strong as the American Ryder Cup team.
Yeah, hard to argue with that after Sunday's performance, but yeah, ruthless from Tiger, even though he's not even on the course.
Maybe that's the most impact he's ever had in a Ryder Cup, is it? This is his role now. It's like a team mascot. There was a piece that the five mistakes that Harrington made, which I think has been carried in the Irish stuff, had come from James Corrigan as well, and essentially not having as many picks, not giving himself as much flexibility, the system that he was up against, some of the pairings, they were all issues. Super League threat has not disappeared, warns UEFA. This is an exclusive from David Kahn. I think you were reading that a little bit earlier on. We'll chat about it in one sec. And then back page of the London Times for now. Westwood's Ryder Cup vision. He's saying that he'd have 4-4-4, 4 off the Euro list, 4 off the world list, and 4 picks, which isn't that different from the situation they had at the moment. He also would change the timing of it. Wentworth is a massive tournament. It should stand on its own. And it does seem as if there was a lot of support for Harrington, where the players certainly weren't blaming him in the aftermath of it, the way that Nick Faldo and his shit show was essentially all on Faldo. And I think the mishandling of Darren Clark, of the Danny Willett stuff, all landed at Clark's feet as well. Whereas this one with Harrington, it sounds like they're giving him the pass that he did everything he was supposed to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Just on that David Kahn story that you mentioned, obviously that was printed last night. There's been a little bit of a development overnight. So about 10 hours ago, UEFA have been forced to declare their disciplinary process against the Super League loyalists. So that's Real Madrid, Juventus and Barcelona, null and void. They'd been stayed because of an earlier threat from a judge who granted Super League teams an injunction against sanctions in April. So that's from a tweet from Tariq Panja. It's interesting going through this story, though. I think there's still a lot of relevant things in it from David Kahn's report, that UEFA reckoned that the European Super League still represents an ongoing existential threat to the foundation and future of European football. So basically the Super League company still exists. It's not like they're trying to do anything outside of those three holdout clubs, but they are maintaining a legal challenge against UEFA. This legal action, though, was taken in a Madrid court all the way back in April, that crazy week, the Super League week, back in April, and all of the 12 clubs involved remain shareholders, and the agreement they signed committing to the breakaway is still in place. Now, as part of the piece, David Kahn tried to contact City, Chelsea, Arsenal and Spurs and received a no comment, but Liverpool and Manchester United both emphatically deny that they, after suggesting they are following different legal advice, which warns against taking action that could be regarded as defying Madrid court orders. So Liverpool and United saying that they're not interested in this anymore, that it's just a difficult thing to wind up this company. But UEFA is very suspicious, and you do wonder if there will be a zombified version of the Super League that will pop up. I think they learned a lot from what happened in April. I think the thing that stuck in the craw of a lot of football fans was the closed off nature of all of this, that I wonder if there is going to be a comeback of the ESL, named something different, of course, because it would be idiotic to call it the Super League once again, where the big clubs...
Mega League.
The European Mega League it comes back, and there is just... there is promotion and relegation and whatever, but maybe with a few caveats here and there and greater funds for the big clubs involved. So UEFA are very paranoid about this. The clubs, especially the three holdout clubs, are maintaining a legal challenge against UEFA. And this thing is not dead yet. Tariq on Twitter said that this case could go for months, maybe even years.
A commenter in on YouTube. Jerry, if I understand you correctly, you want to turn the championship into the Nations League. That's precisely what we're trying not to do. There is a proposal which is essentially going to take the lower performing teams from province A and B, namely the big provinces, and inject them into provinces C and D, namely the smaller provinces, on the basis of league performance and then some kind of pre-tournament round robin where...
The Nations League comparison begins and ends with the fact that Division 3 and Division 4 winners get into Sam Maguire, like how North Macedonia managed to qualify for the Euros this year, for example. That is where the comparisons begin and end. Other than that, I think that the notion is out there that if you don't allow everybody into Sam Maguire at the start of the year, you're not going to have full buy-in from people.
Yeah.
This is exactly what it does.
And in fairness, people from different counties have sat in the studio and said, you want to be playing for Sam Maguire at the start of the year. That's Michael Quinlivan said that. And I can understand why you do that, because especially early on, give everybody the opportunity, see what happens. And over 10 years, if no one from Division 3 ever makes it past the quarterfinal stage, well then that hasn't really worked and maybe it was unnecessary, but maybe it does work, and who knows, maybe somebody goes on a run. And I think the whole point is that if the North Macedonians actually end up qualifying, then shouldn't they be allowed to dream as well over a 2-year period? Isn't that the whole point of that competition. It keeps everybody interested. It keeps everybody invested. It was actually, in the end, something beneficial for football in that part.
Absolutely. And the Nations League we have viewed through the prism of Ireland, which is a little bit of a farce, to be honest, because we got a playoff for the Euros as a result of finishing bottom of the Nations League. You will not get anything in this championship for finishing bottom of anything. In fact, if you finish fifth, sixth in Division 1, you will not even progress to the next round. So there is a much higher stakes scenario for the bigger teams in this format, in Proposal B, than there is in the Nations League. But again, you take the... Yes, you know, I agree with that comment. We're taking the positives from the Nations League.
Yeah.
The positive.
Absolutely. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. I'm going to give you another opportunity to enter our competition. With thanks to Gillette, we're celebrating the return to normality with a special prize of UEFA Champions League tickets to Chelsea against Malmo on the 20th of October with flights and accommodation included. You can enter the competition on the Off the Ball Twitter page, twitter.com/offtheball, where we'll post an image of a bearded sports person every day this week. Just respond to the post and tell us who the person is for your chance to win this amazing prize. Put your best face forward with Gillette. That hashtag is best face forward, and that's a pretty obvious one today, so you can have the opportunity to enter that competition on Twitter. Now, Will O'Callaghan is with us. Will, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, lads. How are you getting on?
Yeah, interesting to see the development of the story with regards to the women's team. It's not gone away. It hasn't disappeared. There's kind of no sense of this being just a bad result at the weekend. Normal service is resumed. Everybody forgets about it. Philip Doyle in The Independent today, speaking with Rory O'Connor, is calling for a change in the coaching ticket. So pressure ratcheting up on the IRFU.
Yeah, I think so. There's probably two strands to the conversation. One is structural around the IRFU, where the targets for both the men's and women's teams have been missed in the period between 2018 and 2023, but particularly on the women's side of the game. I think what's interesting is if you go back and look at the document, which is still available as a PDF on the IRFU's website, that so many of the targets were driven towards the sevens programme, and that's been one of the major issues here, where there has been a focus on the commercial benefits of trying to get into the Women's Sevens World Series and trying to use that as part of the funding model for women's rugby in Ireland. And we've had a lot of sevens players who've been jettisoned into the 15 squad over the last year because of the impact of the pandemic and the, you know, the Seven Series games being on hold. But the Six Nations is going to overlap directly with the Seven season next year. And you would think if the winds of change are coming in, a lot of those sevens players who've been brought in for this World Cup qualifying cycle over the last 6 or 8 months are likely to go back and play sevens, or at least there's going to be a split between their attention. So I think there's probably going to be a new feel to the squad anyway. And we had Claire Malloy announcing her retirement after remarkable performances across her 74 appearances. I think the head scratcher for many of the Irish fans over the last couple of weekends is, why was Claire Malloy not a starting back row for Ireland, given how well she's been playing? She was brilliant off the bench, particularly against Italy, and yet didn't get a start against Scotland. And Adam Griggs was saying last week that he wanted to keep players like Claire Malloy and Lindsay Pete in reserve for the closing stages of games. And I just can't understand why you wouldn't go out and start with your best 15. So probably the two best back rows in the country, Anna Capeless, who's been such a key player for Ireland over the last couple of Six Nations campaigns, lost her place in the squad entirely, which was very unusual. I was talking to Fiona Hayes about this at the weekend, where Anna Capeless had also travelled home to help with her selection for the World Cup qualifiers, and then was told in advance of the squad being picked for Parma that she wasn't going to be needed. And she's gone back now to play semi-pro rugby again in England. So there's that side to it, with Adam Griggs being fairly clear that there's no snap decisions on his part, and that it's up to the RFU to make a call as to whether his contract is going to be extended. And important to remember that Adam Griggs came in on a part-time basis initially for this Ireland head coach role, and then ended up staying around for this campaign trying to qualify for New Zealand, which ultimately ended in failure at the weekend. And then there's the structural side of the RFU with, you know, David Nusafora's contract is up for negotiation currently. There's less than 12 months left in that deal. Philip Brown signaled last week that he will be stepping down and retiring as CEO. So the recruitment process is already underway to try and find his successor. The RFU soundings have always been, Jared, that the women's programme will be well funded. But there's a feeling out there among players and among former players and coaches that that has not been the case, with the slashing of funding over the last couple of years in this World Cup cycle, that an opportunity opportunity was missed in the bigger picture to build on the good performances of 2014, where they were able to beat the Silver Ferns in the pool stage, qualify for the last four of the competition, and so much ground has been lost since, particularly with France and England going semi-pro and professional respectively, that it feels that Ireland, 10 years on from when things looked pretty promising with a couple of Six Nations titles, that now we're a long way away from the rest of the opposition. And I think everything Philip Doyle said kind of reflects what a lot of people are feeling, is that the coaching ticket probably has to be fully replaced, and people are probably going to have to embrace a new wave of players coming in for the Six Nations next year, and they'll have to think in terms of a cycle with the next World Cup in mind when they're blooding new players coming in. But I think they have to be 15-a-side based. I think this project of bringing players who already contracted on the sevens in to play 15s part-time or on a short-term role hasn't worked out this time around.
We're not really a sevens country, are we? It's not really something that's in our rugby tradition. It's not something that has ignited the rugby going, the fans' imagination. It's not something that has really got everybody behind. Okay, so as Owen said, for the 2 days during the Olympics, and the Olympic qualifying was exciting, but like, even if we make the World Series, is everybody going to be watching those week in, week out?
I would imagine not. And I mean, look, it's been great to see the men's program in the sevens overperform. And I think there's like huge benefits to having a successful sevens program, where we've seen players like Robert Balakoon who were involved. Just look at Hugo Keenan, where they've picked up skills that have been very transferable back into
just
the 15s
just
program.
On that, though, is there no sense that Hugo Keenan could have developed by playing a year in England or 2 years in England and then come back, or got game time at one of the other provinces where there wasn't a logjam at fullback, where he wasn't behind Rob Kearney? Like, could he have played in Ulster? Could he have played in I don't know. I'm just like, I definitely see that there was a success for them and they got to be professionals and they got to see exactly what it was like, but there are surely other pathways, or else we're completely stuck.
Yeah, but see, the other thing as well is that the pathway for the best part is a little bit different when it comes to the men's game. So there are exceptions to the rule, like say someone like Jordan Conroy, who hadn't played a huge amount of rugby before he got brought into the sevens program. So he was learning the 15s game and the sevens game at the same time. The issue that we've had here is that we've had so many athletes who've been funneled directly into the women's sevens program. And like, even just talking to Sam Monaghan a couple of weeks ago, who was the starting second row for Ireland for these qualifiers, coming in to win her first cap once Aoife McDermott had fallen out of favour after the first game against Spain. Like, she hadn't played a game of rugby until she went to England a few years ago. She was playing ladies football with Meath. So we're not getting players, and maybe this will improve as we go further down the track, but we've been trying so hard to get players from other sports to convert into playing rugby and fairly short-term projects and talking about transferable skills. And similarly with the sevens, many of these players have grown up sevens first or played sevens since their mid to late teens, and then they're being asked to play 15. And as much as the players talk about, you know, it's easy to make that transition and, you know, it's been eased along the way, there's that definite feeling in the background that Anthony Eddy has made it clear to Adam Griggs that he has to find a place for these players. And your natural instincts change a lot. Like, Stacey Flood's been really good at number 10, but the idea of playing at number 10 is very different to playing scrum half at sevens. Like, that's a lot of learning on the fly when your first games are coming in a Six Nations Championship.
Yeah, so look, the chickens have definitely come home to roost, and it's a story we're going to continue to cover here. Will, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
Cheers, lads.
Will Callaghan giving us some thoughts there on the women's rugby team and updating exactly what the mood music is like around that side. It's 8:43 this morning. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Now, delighted to say Philippe Auclair is with us. We've just lost him there for 1 second. We'll go back to him. Obviously, we want to preview the game between Paris Saint-Germain and Manchester City tonight. This is one of those fixtures that has been a long time in the making, and we really hope that in the group stages they'll both go for it. What's your instinct? What's going to happen?
Well, Manchester City were a good bit better than them last year in the knockout stages, and I think Paris Saint-Germain haven't been good of late, and Manchester City have been good of late. So recent form and the more elongated sense of the form line would suggest that Manchester City are going to win at home for sure tonight in Paris. I think Manchester City might actually nick something too.
Okay, Philippe Auclair, good morning to you. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
I don't know if you've read Philippe Lam this morning. It's carried in all the Irish newspapers. It's from The Guardian. He's talking about the...
Oh, God, yes, I have, yes.
The experiment of putting the humans on display the way that the rich people put luxury goods on display for us mere mortals to walk through and look at but don't touch. It's an interesting metaphor for what's going on at the moment. And he's obviously a thoughtful footballer, former footballer. You always have a very good sense of the geopolitics and what this all means. What does tonight's fixture mean to you?
to me, my goodness. To be honest, not much. Can I say that?
Yeah, go for it.
It's an interesting one. I mean, it's an interesting one for... I'm interested in it particularly on the PSG side. There's, of course, the whole geopolitical side of it, which is not perhaps as important today as it would have been, let's say, 2 years ago, or when there was a real tension between the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, and Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and Egypt and Qatar, and so on. And the situation has evolved since then. There has been some kind of rapprochement, which is purely of facade, but nevertheless is there. So we don't quite have the same, I was going to say, political aggro that we would have had in this strange derby of after a fashion a few years ago. But there is still, obviously, two models which are completely different. In terms of the way that they are used in football and the way the methodology they use or the absence of methodology they use, but which are very similar in essence, despite what some people say that Manchester City is not really the Emirati project, it's Sheikh Mansour. But I think we're big enough to understand that Sheikh Mansour is the royal family of Abu Dhabi and therefore it is Abu Dhabi. But they've gone about their business in a completely different fashion from Paris Saint-Germain. And what we have today, and I suppose that's what is interesting, is to see another confrontation between two superpowers, financial superpowers of football, who have gone about their business of trying to put a case for, well, the regime that they are basically representing in very different fashion. And one of them, which appears chaotic and is chaotic, which is PSG. The other, which appears to be extremely well thought and well organized, which is Manchester City. So you've got, I suppose, a confrontation between two methods, if the PSG method can be called a method, because, to be honest, it's chaos. But it's worked up to a point. And I think the question is, well, which one is going to work in the end? Because they're both going after the same thing, which they still haven't won, which is the Champions League. So there are many things which are interesting. But in a way, this is a conversation we're having all of the time. Every time these two cross paths or every time we enter a new Champions League campaign, this is what it's about. With PSG, there's an added, I must say, I'm more interested in what is happening with PSG at the moment, because obviously there is so much, there's such a circus around this team this season that I'm quite almost like I'm a spectator and I'm quite intrigued to find out exactly how it's going to pan out. Because to be honest, if that's the way we are and we are not yet in October and we already have got all this circus around this particular team, my goodness, what it's going to be in a couple of months' time? What's it going to be at the end of the season? It's astonishing.
It really is, because their range of outcomes is almost endless. Like they could lose a couple of games now and Pochettino gets sacked and who knows what happens. Or Pochettino might be somehow able to get a hold of things and they could go on a run. And everything in between is a potential outcome. It could just kind of peter out into nothingness with a quarterfinal defeat or a semi-final defeat where they get absolutely destroyed by a team who knows what they're doing. Maybe it'd be interesting to see them come up against Tuchel again. But in terms of that circus that's happening at the moment, how much control do you believe Pochettino is exerting? And where is he in his evolution as somebody who is supposed to be in charge and is behaving like somebody in charge?
Only at the start, I mean, for a very simple reason, is that the main problem he's got to solve is how to play the three Fantasticos together. And that up till now, events have been such that he really didn't have a go at it. I mean, there was the game against Brugge. There was the games against Olympique Lyonnais. They were far from convincing, either of them. And we are back now. Messi has been out with a little injury and he's back now to play against Manchester City. So here we go again at the chalkboard and try to understand how to make this work. Because for the rest, I think he's identified more or less what he wanted his team to be. Certainly the players would be at the heart of it. But it's almost impossible for him to materialize, so to speak, the idea he must have got in his mind of what his team should look like and play like, because to be honest, it's not working. And you wonder how it can work. And these were the questions. I mean, I think what was most intriguing for us. We were all thinking when Messi joined the club, how Pochettino is going to make this work with Mbappe and Neymar and Di Maria, let's not forget, is going to be absolutely fascinating to watch. Can he do it? And most of us, I would think, said, no, we don't think so. And we are now at a stage where there are now 8 rounds of the French League have gone past. We're in the second day of the Champions League. And to be honest, we don't have a much clearer idea of what's, if he has a solution in mind. So it's going to go on and on and on and on. So what kind of control has he got? Well, he's got some control. After all, don't forget, he subbed Lionel Messi. Not many people have done that. You know, it's one thing to sub him in a match when it's 5-0, 5 minutes to go. It's quite another to sub him when he did, when the outcome of the game was far from a cert. And in fact, they won after Messi went off the pitch. So you can see he has a measure of control. He's already exerted it. And believe me, in France, it was not about the game. It was about the cameras following Messi getting off the pitch, his facial expressions, his body language. What does it mean? And, you know, all this kind of speculation. But it had been a strong choice by Pochettino, which, by the way, worked. But he hasn't gone to the point where we can see that it is a step in the right direction, because what this direction takes him to, we don't know. We know what his defense is going to look like. We've got an idea of what his midfield is going to look like, especially now that Marco Verratti is back, fortunately for PSG. But as the team as a whole, we don't know. We don't know. It's in a strange way, a little bit like what's happening with Manchester United. Solskjaer has been in place for a very long time. We still don't know exactly what kind of game he would like his team to play. Well, at PSG, with different players, different context, but it's about the same situation. We do not really know how he wants this team to play.
Does Maurizio Pochettino, Philippe, have the bottle to drop one of his three fantasticals from the start in a big game?
I don't think it's going to happen against Manchester City, unless there are, you know, physical problems and so forth. I very much doubt it. I mean, you can imagine the consequences, the impact. When you see what's happened in France over the last 2 days, 2-3 days, because a camera and microphone picked what Kylian Mbappe was telling Idriss Gueye about Neymar. Can you imagine? I mean, it is in a way unmanageable, or rather it's unmanageable, just like things were unmanageable at Real Madrid, you know, at one stage. As in, Pochettino is going to have to find a way where he can live above this constant hubbub and constant speculation, recrimination, stories invented or not invented, all this sort of, he's going to have to find a way to be above that. How it is possible at Paris Saint-Germain, to be honest, I'm not absolutely sure.
This Neymar Mbappe beef is quite fascinating. Mm. What side of the fence do you reckon the PSG fans are going to fall down on this one? Because it does seem that the Mbappe love isn't what it once was.
No, it's not exactly what it once was, even though if you look at what's happened since the beginning of the season, of all the star players of PSG, Mbappe has been the most consistent and the most efficient. But it's true that the things he has said and the things he hasn't said, which pointed out his desire to leave the club, obviously for Real Madrid, haven't gone very well at all with part of the fans, of the supporters. So there's still an awful lot of there's a lot of Neymar love. There's obviously an awful lot of Messi love, and it's quite obvious that should there be a shift within the team between the three, I think most Parisian fans, strangely enough, would probably be happier to see Mbappe being the victim of it than the other two. But it's because of what happened, you know, between the two seasons and this perception that he actually agitated for a move and that his behavior was not what he should have been, that he was not loyal to the club, all these sort of things. And of course, as we are approaching, nearing the end of his contract, which is June next year, things are not going to get exactly easier. So of the three, Mbappé is obviously in the most delicate situation, even though on the pitch, he's the one who's been delivering the goods.
It feels to me like there is a manager out there who is perfect for this scenario of managing Galacticos who...
Yes, there is, yes.
...aren't really that interested in the league, but who really, yes, really desperately, absolutely want to win a Champions League. And what is preventing Zinedine Zidane from being the manager of Paris Saint-Germain?
An awful lot of things. It's a question that really intrigued me because I thought he would be perfect. Mm. And as well, don't forget that Zinedine Zidane was an ambassador for Qatar 2022, which helps. So obviously he will know an awful lot of people who are involved with QSI and PSG. But I've been told in no uncertain fashion by one person in particular who knows him quite well that it was strictly out of the question. It was never going to happen. And is it because Zidane has quite he does know what it feels like at Real Madrid, and it was difficult enough at the time, and he thinks, oh my goodness, that's literally from the frying pan into the fire, and that's one hell of a fire if I have to take care about those guys. And that also, his main ambition now was to coach the French national team, and surely that cannot be happening in too long, because it's very unlikely. I find it very unlikely that Didier Deschamps should stay beyond the 2022 World Cup, which is only, to be honest, just a year away. So it's not going to happen. But I agree with you. I think it would be an obvious choice. I think that also in another way, they already had a manager who was perfect for this type of situation, whom they got rid of, who was Carlo Ancelotti. It would have been, I think, a much better kind of manager to have at that time, right now, than Pochettino, who tactically might be, people might say, a superior manager. And, yeah, you know, but Ancelotti, again, big name, has won, you know, the Champions League as a player as well as a manager, one of the most respected technicians. So you can carry on. And there aren't that many around who could take that kind of mantle, who have got the dimension, the aura, and Zinedine Zidane is one of them. Pochettino, his strength is that he's a man who has got tremendous willpower. He's somebody who can have a vision and implement it. He's somebody also who won't hesitate to take difficult decisions at one point or the other. The question is, will he be allowed to do so? And that, with PSG, it's always a question. You never quite know you know, where their managers could achieve, because they don't have enough elbow space, so to speak, to do what they really want to do. Listen, they parted with Thomas Tuchel. I mean, how stupid have you got to be to do that? I mean, it defies belief. And now they're coming back, some of the PSG fans saying, well, maybe the problem was not Tuchel. And you say, guys, that's what we've been saying from the beginning. You know, Ancelotti was not the problem. Not even sure that Unai Emery was the problem, because he's done all right. Actually, he might not be the kind of manager you want in a huge mega club. He might not be, I don't know, sexy enough. I don't know. But yet, you know, you were all for him, and you carry on. And the list of managers said that the only managers, as you said, probably could withstand all this pressure and gel this very strange motley crew into a functioning unit are people like Carlo Ancelotti and, as you said, Zinedine Zidane. But it's not going to happen.
Okay, that, I mean, just purely for the theatre and the spectacle, it would be really interesting to see that happen. And Zidane has to kind of have some job between now and the end of the World Cup at the end of 2022, or is it possible that somebody else might nip in ahead of him and be in pole position for the French manager's job? Or is that not what he says, that my CV is good enough, I'm the absolute legend, I'm going to be capable of taking on the team no matter what after 2022?
Listen, if Didier Deschamps were to leave after 2022 and Zinedine Zidane were available and he was not picked by the French Federation, I think the headquarters of the French Federation would have to look at what happened at the Bastille on 14 July 1789 to get an idea of their choice, how good their choice was.
Okay, fair enough. That's so he could have a nice year out. Go and do some co-commentary in the World Cup. Show up, be an
absolutely
ambassador.
Take care of the career of his sons, and do all these things. Absolutely,
fair enough. What do you think will happen tonight in the game between Paris Saint-Germain and Manchester City?
I would expect myself City to overwhelm PSG's midfield, despite the return of Verratti, for the simple reason is that we've got one team that, as we saw over the weekend against Chelsea, has probably got, there are no people do better what they do, which is the high pressure of the opponent, very high up the pitch. And PSG is the absolute opposite. There's absolutely no pressure exerted by Mbappé, Neymar and Messi. So it's very easy, when you're Manchester City, to actually work out the ball from your own half. And then quite easy as well to outnumber in midfield and to press high. And for this reason, I cannot see beyond a Manchester City win, even if you have got a couple of strokes of genius, because that's always possible from either, of these players, or even from the very unlikely source of goals that PSG has had since the beginning of the season, under Herrera, who's got as many goals as Kylian Mbappe and four times as many goals as Neymar, which is quite extraordinary thing to say. But I would say, yes, I would expect normally Manchester City to boss that game, to control it and to win it, unless, again, they have against... I mean, unless there's, exploits from the three, which is always possible. But normally, I mean, Manchester City is, not just on paper, is a far superior team at the moment.
Philippe, great to have you with us. Enjoy the game tonight. Thanks a million.
I will. Thank you.
It's Philippe Auclair giving us his thoughts there. Another potential storming of the Bastille if they get the decision wrong.
That's it. It seems that that's going to happen now at the end of the next year. So Zidane's got a year and a half just to stay patient, not go in two-footed on anything, not headbutt a situation that presents itself like a Paris Saint-Germain job.
What about the Man United job?
Could also be a sort of factor. I do wonder, will PSG, by the start of next season, actually be a very different feeling club, where they realise that this just isn't going to work? So they're not going to have Kylian Mbappe to start of next season. How many more years are they going to have Messi? Is it going to be this season and next season and then that's it?
Probably, yeah.
And then where's Neymar going to be after that? Like, the Galactico project is always a very interesting conversation about how effective it is, especially when it gets into the latter stages of the Champions League. Like, I know you point to Cristiano Ronaldo as the Galactico in that Real Madrid team, but that Galactico project had been scaled down in its extravagance. It felt to a point when Real Madrid started winning Champions Leagues. Yes, they had Gareth Bale in there as well, but it wasn't the sort of one a year and we have to tick a box every sort of year sort of job. It was, we will spend massive money if this player is going to be the best in the world and actually be a sustainable force for us. Like Messi, I think Messi's been good for Paris Saint-Germain this season, by the way. I really do. But for the critics of him, they could possibly say that he feels like a Galactico signing, that it was a ticking of the box. This is a big name. Whereas maybe Ronaldo and Bale in that Real Madrid team were two of the best players in the world. And like they were at the peak of their powers and were always going to be effective. The Galactico project is more than just about how effective you are. It's about a big name.
Well, losing Mbappe for free, I mean, the free obviously bit doesn't matter, but allowing Mbappe to get to the point where he has a freedom of movement, that just suggests that the club isn't being particularly well run. And if you're like long-terming this, if you are trying to sell this as the best job in world football, but you've just let Mbappe go and you've got aging superstar who glares at you every time you sub him off, and it's going to be happening more and more often. He's going to be injured more often because that's what happens to players at the end of their career. And you've got Neymar who occasionally tries, and when he does, he's brilliant. But when he doesn't try, he's a complete passenger. It's not really the best job in world football anymore. So you've got to try and replace Mbappe with Haaland, and maybe Haaland doesn't want to come there, like, to be the third banana. I don't know.
Mbappe and Haaland together would also be sensational.
And you can have that for 50 million next year, right?
Yeah,
or 85, whatever the buyout clause that Dortmund have for Haaland. So free Mbappe for free and Haaland. Now, do they want to go and be overshadowed, or do they want to go and dream team this? I don't know.
There is also another option here, and that's, like you said to Philippe there, and you're right that anything, there's a whole suite of options here. One of them is that things do sort themselves out.
Yeah.
That Messi is like, grow up, lads. Listen, cop on. The three of us are so good at what we do. We can absolutely win this competition if we just get our house in order. But the likelihood does seem that the three of them on the pitch together maybe isn't going to be effective enough. And like you can kind of see out of the three of them, it seems like Neymar is actually the one you would probably keep at the moment. Like in terms of his effort off the ball, it seems an extraordinary thing to say is kind of at a higher rate than the other two, and his effectiveness in the final third obviously is at an unreal level. So he seems to be the leader of that attack.
Well, yeah, and the Messi Neymar relationship obviously is deep. And they've been buddies for a long time. And Mbappe must be feeling a little bit like, well, I mean, I just want to be Luis Suarez in this, but they're different characters, obviously. So we'll see what happens tonight. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Here's what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio today. It's Wexford 1956, Art Foley and Ned Wheeler, the late great Art Foley and Ned Wheeler, talking to us at 1 o'clock. A Dadcast episode from 3, career retrospective of Paddy Bonner at 4. OTB Gold is Joe meeting Ruby Walsh at 6 o'clock tonight. Up next, we're going to be joined by Ronan Mullen to talk boxing. We have another chance to enter this morning's competition right after these.
OTB
AM. 7 minutes past 9 this morning. Now, thanks to Gillette, we're celebrating the return to normality with a special prize of UEFA Champions League tickets to watch Chelsea against Malmo on the 20th of October with flights and accommodation included. You can enter the competition through the Off the Ball Twitter page, where we'll be posting an image of a bearded sports person every day this week. Just respond to the post that's pinned on our account now and tell us who the person is for your chance to win this amazing prize. Put your best face forward with Gillette, and the hashtag is best face forward. Ronan Mullen joins us to talk to us about the fallout from the Anthony Joshua fight at the weekend. Ronan, good morning to you. How are you?
Oh, good, Jay. How are things?
So, walking along and look up, and there's a billboard, and it's Anthony Joshua advertising a sports drink, and the words "Be humble" are emblazoned across the sports drink, and I'm like, well, it's going to be pretty easy for him to be humble after that, because he was absolutely humbled at the weekend.
Yeah, it seems, and it's probably something we can delve into, but in the ring, he seems to be caught between a couple of different styles in terms of his approach to these fights. And similarly, like that billboard you're alluding to, his sort of public persona, as opposed to the Anthony Joshua we see every now and then, you know, when he actually puts his actual personality out there, you know, he's quite an engaging character, but he's got this sort of media driven, polished persona that has been sort of molded since he turned pro. And I think increasingly, and we've only had two examples of this so far, but in his losses he tends to open up a bit, and as you said, like, he could not but be sort of humble after that defeat at the weekend, because it was conclusive. I was there for the Andy Ruiz one, and that was a bolt from the blue. Like, the oxygen just dissipated from the arena, such was the shock. It was kind of going Joshua's way. He was floating along, and then Andy Ruiz caught him with a bit of a freak punch in the top of the head, and he could never sort of redress that balance. But on this occasion, it was just from the off, Usyk, the master craftsman, just implemented his game plan and didn't give Anthony Joshua a sniff. There was a little period in the middle of the fight maybe where you felt the tide was turning, and Joshua's got this sort of golden snitch effect, like in Harry Potter, where the fight could be going one way, but it doesn't matter because he can end it at any one point. Not necessarily at one punch to end the fight, but one punch to turn the tide. And that just never came. So if anything, I thought Usyk outboxed him for the first half of the fight, and then when it mattered at the end, at the crunch, he outfought him, crucially. So it was a very comprehensive win from the Ukrainian.
Talk to us about that personality, will you? Who is Anthony Joshua, and how much are we actually missing out on by only ever seeing the polished persona?
Yeah, it's interesting because you see some people are, well, namely as competitors and maybe knockers from the off are gleefully rejoicing in this defeat, saying he's a hype job. These people obviously aren't familiar with the art of professional boxing, which is literally that, to hype your fighter and to like dismiss Eddie Hearn and Anthony Joshua for trying to build the best brand possible is a misnomer as far as I'm concerned. But like in any sort of brief dealings I've had with him in the past, it's definitely off the record when he's having, you can kind of see what he's really like as a person, and the media briefings he does, sort of catchphrases and slogan driven stuff, you know, that's that would be more the PR driven side of things. Whereas I think when you actually catch him in more casual settings, he is quite an engaging character. So I don't know, he like his approach to these fights can vary. There was kind of inclinations earlier in the week, last week, that he was trying to almost act relaxed, and that was borne out in his ring walk, which is actually a fantastic ring walk, Rocky IV style. But he was almost trying to exude this to Usyk as like, this is my domain, I belong here. And that wouldn't nearly work on other fighters. You know, it's that Mike Tyson effect of they're almost beaten before the first bell. Like, how could you not look around at 65,000 or whatever was there at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium and see this guy as the king of the castle and not be a little bit perturbed? But if anything, Usyk rose to the occasion. Like, this guy is a road warrior. He won all of his cruiserweight titles in his opponent's backyard, went and knocked out Tony Bellew in Liverpool, and then came to London Town, like a couple of miles down the road from where Anthony Joshua used to train, and absolutely dismissed him with aplomb. So as much as Joshua has a good personality, I think we might be seeing a lot more of Alexander Usyk. I know boxing fans are very familiar with his jovial personality. Him and Lomachenko are like thick as thieves, and you know, as much as they're sort of captivating guys in the ring, they've got sort of charm about them outside it. So the Klitschkos are gone, but Ukraine has got its new sort of hotbed of boxing at the moment.
We'll talk about Usyk in a moment. I just want to linger on Joshua and what happens next. So we've seen him come back from a defeat, and it was fairly comprehensive, his comeback. The issue was, though, that Ruiz came back, it seemed like having partied as the heavyweight champ. It was like, this is completely unexpected. I've won the lotto. And I'm going to live that life. And fair play to him, he went and lived his best life, and that fight was essentially the rematch was essentially over before it began, and we knew that when we saw the shape that he presented himself back in. That's not going to happen in this instance. So how do you plot a course for a comeback here? Does it have to automatically go through with the rematch, or does he actually just go and try and take one of the other big fights where he is an underdog and gets up for that, and that's his way back in?
Yeah, it seems I kind of would err towards the second option there, where I don't see a necessarily a path to victory for him short of like just knocking him out. Like, I can't see him ever winning or ever like turning that tide wholly where he can exude dominance over Usyk in the ring. So it would just be a case of going hell for leather in the first couple of rounds, which is not necessarily Anthony Joshua's style. He's more of a mid-range fighter. He's never been a brawler, but the one distinct advantage he had over Usyk and will always have over Usyk is his size, and he wasn't able to make that a factor the other night. So it is interesting, and it's kind of the Floyd Mayweatherification of boxing, where defeats somehow mean you go right down the pecking order, when, as we all know, the best boxers of yore all have a slew of defeats on their record. That doesn't necessarily mean anything. It just means that they're fighting the best, and when the best fight each other, this is what happens. And when the undisputed cruiserweight champion moves up to fight the unified heavyweight champion, those are the fights we want to see, and that's what happened at the weekend. So there's no shame in Joshua losing to Usyk, but as you alluded to there, whether he can actually win a rematch is kind of the key point here. Where the demand is, like, can he still fill stadiums in the UK with defeats on his record as they start to build up, because people are going to start looking at him and realise that it's not quite the item that's been marketed to them for years, that he's not this untouchable behemoth. So I think he, like, styles make fights, which is that boxing adage, but I think Joshua would have a chance against the likes of Fury. Him against Wilder would be a firefight, but Usyk just looks like too tough a nut to crack for him, as far as I'm concerned. So as much as they're hell-bent on taking the rematch, and you can't write anything off in heavyweight boxing, I think we're probably going to see a similar pattern, if anything. And Kenny Egan made a point like this last night. I think Usyk saw towards the end of that fight that he can stop Joshua, and his corner were almost dissuading him from doing that for fear of maybe putting himself in harm's way. But I think he knows now he can get to Joshua, and you could probably see a more conclusive win next time around.
It's remarkable that we're actually talking about Anthony Joshua in this way, that if you go back 2 years, if you go back before the Ruiz fight, even talking about Tyson Fury as somebody who might be able to beat Anthony Joshua would have been maybe a tiny bit of a reach, not a big reach, but Anthony Joshua would have been favoured. This guy was being spoken about as one of the greatest of all time, not just one of the greatest of his generation, and now we're talking about him as somebody who is an underdog in a number of potential fights in this generation. So has he disimproved, or has he been, or was he totally overrated in 19, or which one of those two things is closer to the truth?
I think the Ruiz fight, as much as it was a physical knockback in the fact that he was stopped in that fight, it's definitely the psychological aspect of it. And we've seen that in heavyweight boxing with the likes of Lennox Lewis and Vladimir Klitschko, who were stopped sort of early in their career, maybe in the mid part, and just totally changed their styles, became a lot less aggressive. And Vladimir Klitschko was very much belt and braces towards the latter end of his career. And Joshua, in so much as they actually fought each other, is like a big fan of Klitschko, and you can kind of sense he's trying to model himself on that. But as I said at the top, he's kind of caught between what he wants to be, because what made Anthony Joshua great in the early part of his career was sensing vulnerability in his opponent, maybe seeking out that vulnerability and pouncing on it. Whereas now it's almost like he's waiting for the opportunity to present itself. And against someone like Usyk, they're not going to give you those openings. Fury, the same thing. Like, as much as I think Fury would probably engage with Joshua a bit more up close, maybe give him those openings, and that's why he might give him some opening into that fight. And Wilder, similarly, like, that would just be a total firefight between himself and Joshua. So I think people would still like to see that come what may, regardless of what happens in that trilogy between Wilder and Fury. But yeah, no, it is a bit of a mad one, because like casual sports fans would look at Joshua and how he's been built and presume, you know, he's untouchable, but it's very much not the case. And to his credit, you look at his resume, he's fought a string of really impressive fighters on the run here, and Usyk was a mandatory challenger, but we've seen in boxing history that doesn't necessarily mean anything. He could just as easily have dropped that belt. Usyk wasn't a money fight, quote unquote. Like, the draw in that one was Joshua to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. It wasn't as if Usyk was playing any great part in that, and it was a high risk, low reward fight for Joshua, and unfortunately he got his comeuppance in that one.
You mentioned the Mayweather aspect of boxing. Is there a chance that the couple of defeats actually increases the interest in Anthony Joshua, that people are showing up because they want to cheer on their man, they want to cheer on the hometown fighter who they do not know whether or not he's going to win or not?
Yeah, it's a whole new dynamic, because as you said, you look at the fights at the top of that heavyweight division, short of Wilder, you'd have to make Joshua a distinct underdog in all of them. And also the frustration amongst the boxing community that these fights weren't made at the zenith when they should have been. Like, you cast your mind back to Fury, or get to Wilder Joshua, when they were both undefeated and for an undisputed championship, like two mega punchers, and that would have been like manna from heaven for the likes of ESPN to try and brand build that. It could have been one that catapulted boxing back into the mainstream. Similarly, like, we saw the talk over here, like, Fury Joshua would have just broken all manner of records. I think any prospect of that going to the likes of Saudi Arabia now are probably gone. Like, does it still have the lure that it did in other parts of the world? If anything, if there's one sort of silver lining from all this, is that Fury Joshua fight in spectacle terms will probably happen in the UK if it does happen. And that's where, like, realistically it should happen. If it's going to be at like Wembley Stadium or something, a fight that goes down in the annals, it should happen on their home soil. So like, I think those fights will still happen, but they probably don't have the glamour they once did.
Well, I'm not sure now. I'm concerned that what's happened is that we end up, that might happen, but it'll happen in the way that Mayweather-Pacquiao happened way after it should have happened. And like, is everybody not just kind of crying this morning and since the defeat, going, why didn't we just take the 200 million when it was there for us? Why didn't we just take the money on the table instead of trying to make it into a $500 million fight, when actually that fight at that price was the right fight at the right time?
Yeah, well, the Wilder Joshua one is unforgivable, because that's a couple of years ago now, and then Joshua lost to Ruiz, and subsequently Wilder had his thing with Fury, and that just sort of unraveled. But the Fury Joshua one, in defense of parties involved, like, Hearn had that fight made for this year, and it kind of plays into a little bit of how this Usyk fight slipped under the radar, because everybody was like building themselves up to watch Joshua Fury around November time this year, and then Wilder won his legal case, essentially, to force the trilogy. And this all happened quite quickly, where Usyk was kind of put on ice, knowing that the Fury-Joshua fight was about to happen, and was told, you can fight next. But then when that fight fell apart, Usyk was basically slotted in as Joshua's next opponent, and Joshua went from fighting Fury to fighting a whole different kettle of fish in Usyk. So I think people probably thought, it's not Fury, so we're not that interested. But I think most people in boxing would have known that if Usyk can implement his game plan effectively here, he's going to win. So yeah, like, I kind of agree that the Joshua Wilder one is like that's the one that got away, but Joshua Fury, they essentially had it made, and it was kind of legal.
I'm sure they could have given Wilder enough money to make that legal challenge go away. They could have found enough cash. What's the price point there? Come on, lads. You can fight the winner. We'll write that into the contract. And then you give Usyk enough money to just kick his down and everybody's happy.
Yeah, it was a really odd one. Like, it was... Hearn was basically saying, we're going to announce this tomorrow, and then tomorrow became next week, and then it became a couple of weeks time, and then you were kind of thinking, what's going on here? And then I think Wilder, for all that you said that, and I kind of agree, you could have just given him whatever X amount of money and he would have waited. He seemed hell-bent on having another fight with Fury, and to what extent that's wise after what Fury did to him in the second fight, we'll see in a couple of weeks. But like, who's to say Wilder doesn't spark Fury in a couple of weeks, and this whole thing is up in the air again. So this is heavyweight boxing, Jerry. Anything can happen.
In that instance, right, and just the way you've spoken about it here, there is definitely a comeback for Joshua, where he dominates the cruiserweight and he uses his height advantage and his reach advantage and his weight advantage and actually finishes that fight early. He tires out his opponent. It'd be a quantum leap forward for him in terms of boxing intelligence, and we haven't seen it before, but it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that at 31... with 20 odd fights, he's actually some penny drops. And at that point, then everything else is back on the table again. It's like, oh, hang on a second. You took the belt back. That's an incredible comeback story. Is that the next fight? Is that what happens next? The rematch happens straight away? Is that the right thing for them to do?
I think if I was advising them, I'd probably advise against it. But like, if they do pull off that redemption story, that redemptive arc, it would be something else. Like, we're talking about different narratives that can be built around Joshua, that sort of everyman thing, that Rocky comeback, where for the first time in his career, I believe, he's going to be going into this one as an underdog. So even in the Ruiz rematch, people denoted that as a bit of a one-off occurrence. Even though Ruiz was a problematic style for Joshua, they figured he would get it right in the rematch. And he fought a very safety-first approach in that Ruiz rematch. It was kind of trying to stymie any threat from Ruiz, and he basically walked to a points decision. Whereas in this one, if he tries to outbox Usyk, which he did at the weekend and was kind of baffling, that seemed to be the game plan, he's got no chance. So yeah, he's going to have to throw caution to the wind in a rematch. And it should make for a fantastic fight if Joshua does actually press the action in the early going. But it's an interesting one. Rob McCracken took a lot of stick, Joshua's coach Robert McCracken, after the Ruiz fight, and there was talk of maybe getting a new coach in, and Joshua plumped to stick with McCracken but added different pieces around him. And you saw it in the corner there at the weekend, there was so many different voices. McCracken was telling him to do one thing, and then Joshua was going into the ring and doing totally different things. So I think that's something they need to sort out pretty quickly. Like, what kind of fighter is Joshua trying to be? I appreciate Usyk has 350 amateur fights plus his accelerated pro career, which has been unparalleled, but Joshua is very much learning on the job. He won his gold medal quickfire fashion, was like obviously plumped into the pros and built into the marquee fighter he became. But through his career, he's basically been like learning as he goes, and it's a bit late for that now. I think he is what he's going to be, and he has to kind of decide now what that is. And I think for the Usyk fight in particular, he needs to go back to basics and use that size advantage. I know it's not necessarily his approach, but try and lean on him where possible, because you know what, that's what Fury would do if he fought Usyk. He'd as he did with Wilder, he'd use that superior size advantage. So if anything, there was a long time there in the early part of this century where the Klitschkos ruled the roost, and there didn't seem to be any outlet for other fighters to emerge. At least now we've got all these different dynamics to talk about. So heavyweight boxing is alive and well.
Yeah, the four kings. Did AJ turn off Rocky IV immediately after Apollo Creed's ring walk, asks Aina Finn on YouTube?
No Easy Way Out has to be the best walkout song ever, but you have to win though. You can't come out to No Easy Way Out and then lose.
Can he do it again?
Oh, I don't know. See, now what he has to do if he wants to go full Rocky is go to Ukraine and knock Usyk out. That's the only way to really reverse this issue. But like, you have to hand it to Usyk. The man is just not... He's unflappable. It's incredible that he seems to... Like, the more difficult the task, the more brilliant he seems to be. And I can't imagine, as you kind of alluded to with Ruiz, that he... The glitz and glamour of it all, he was on Jimmy Fallon, he was on Jimmy Kimmel, he was on all the Jimmys over in America, and I don't think Usyk's going to be going in for any of that. So he's going to be, he's a boxer through and through, and he's not going to, he's been there and done it. Like, he's followed Evander Holyfield into this rarefied air alongside David Haye of people who've, like, unified cruiserweight division, gone up and won at heavyweight. And like Holyfield, he's like a de facto champion. Like, he's beaten one of the top dogs in the heavyweight division and did it impressively. So yeah, I don't think if Joshua's relying on some Usyk complacency, it's not going to be forthcoming as far as I'm concerned.
Is this unparalleled where we've seen somebody this quickly reach this level of acclaim and titles, and to go from the cruiserweight to the heavyweight like that and to be so dominant? My boxing history knowledge is not sufficient to say it's never happened before, but it feels like it's kind of once in an epoch.
Well, like when David Haye essentially was undisputed cruiserweight champion, there was a little bit of politics going on there, so he didn't get all of the belts, but he was the de facto top guy at cruiserweight. Then he moved up and beat Valuev for the heavyweight title, but as we touched on there a few minutes ago, Valuev wasn't necessarily considered the top champion. The two Klitschkos were the guys to beat. On that occasion, Haye ultimately fought Vladimir and lost, whereas Evander Holyfield is the other comparable one, where he was... did both in the 90s. He was immaculate cruiserweight, and then like was a really forceful heavyweight, had those classic fights with Mike Tyson, maybe more memorable than classic, but then he fought Lennox Lewis, so he had a brilliant heavyweight career to follow up his cruiserweight career. But yeah, like what Usyk has done, he's put himself in a very limited group here, and ironically Lomachenko would be the other one who's kind of fast-tracked his way off the back of that amateur pedigree in his late 20s into these mid-30s now, where he's just making up for last time. Usyk was world champion, or undisputed world champion, after 15 fights. And now, like a couple of years later, he's one belt away from doing the same thing at heavyweight. The tricky one about Fury, should Fury win that Wilder fight? And there's no guarantee of that either. But I think the problem for Usyk there would be he's basically fighting a bigger version of himself. And like, as technically proficient as Usyk is, Fury can boast that too, and probably has more strings to his bow in a strictly professional sense. So that'd be a very intriguing fight. You'd have to lean towards Fury just on the basis of that size, but like, pound for pound is a thing that boxing people like to talk about, is if lads from certain divisions were all fighting at the same weight, who would be the best? And to Usyk's credit, he's given away a big amount of weight to these heavyweights and still outboxing them. So to that end, I think if you're talking about best boxers on the planet right now, I think Usyk could have to be one, possibly two at this point.
Right, good stuff, Ronan. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
Cheers, lads.
Ronan Mullen gave us some thoughts on the boxing situation at the heavyweights at the moment. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. A couple of comments coming in, I suppose, that we should get to from a little bit earlier on. Rice is better than Phillips, says Ryan, very simply. Rice probably is better than Phillips, but if Phillips is going to be half the price, do you care that Rice is better than Phillips? Or is that Man United's problem, that their squad is full of the Anthony Martials of the world, the Diego Dalots, in the past, the Ander Herreras, where if they just had like lumped them all into one super player, it didn't really work out with Jadon Sancho yet, did it?
I think that in this position you have to go for the best player. It's such a vital cog for Manchester United. It is probably the most talked about position in the Premier League right now when it comes to an absence, and it is Manchester United's midfielder.
Yeah, and you've got to go back to the other scenarios in recent history where there were clubs who had players that were as badly exposed as this. And you think of the goalkeeping position under Arsenal that they didn't fix, and you think of the goalkeeper centre back position under Liverpool that they did fix, and then they became one of the best teams in world football.
Yeah. Like, who would have been the budget version of Virgil van Dijk, for example? Whoever it was, it probably wouldn't have led to Liverpool.
Victor Lindelof?
Like, I mean, it seems ridiculous to say that now, but potentially, And the same goes then for Alisson and goals. So sometimes when it comes to these glaring weaknesses in your squad, the team will, that you are buying from will know that you have a glaring weakness in your squad, and you will just have to pay a premium price. Maybe they should have done it this summer though, and maybe that's why they didn't.
Doesn't Prop B pit teams at a similar level against one another with a prize, a crack at Sam at the end to create more meaningful games? How is this wildly different from the Nations League?
Because this is the biggest competition in the sport. The Nations League is, what, the third biggest competition in the sport? Like, format-wise, you've got all these mini groups. They all come together and you
win the World Cup at the end of it. That's it. Maybe they can rebrand the Sam Maguire the World Championships. Oh, we just ruined it. Everybody was on board until we started shouting around like that. Podge is dead right. I said for years, league is best, says Michael. I think that is the truth. I just can't see any reason not to do it. Certainly, we've spoken with people who are off the record saying they think that sure, the league does the job it's supposed to do, and the league is league, championship. Why would you change what's there? And it's like, well, the women fixed it. Hurling is getting there. Come on, just give it to us,
please. Just for the love of God,
we're begging.
Please, we've only got so many years on this earth. Like, I mean,
I'm halfway there. Yeah.
Why do we have to? Why do you have to put up with a crap football championship for any more years? Life is short. And that goes for you at Congress as well. Life is short for you too. So do it for you. What do you want to see? Maybe you want to see bad games, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Paris Saint-Germain against Man City, Champions League tonight. AC Milan against Atletico. Porto against Liverpool. Leipzig against Brugge. Ajax versus Besiktas, Borussia Dortmund versus Sporting Lisbon, Shakhtar versus Inter, Real Madrid versus FC Sheriff. We'll be talking about all of those on the show tomorrow. A reminder, we're brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors. In studio, Kenny Cunningham, Nathan Murphy's going to join us from 7:30. Our feast of football, rugby with Keith Wood, Champions League with Graham Hunter.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.